Radio.
Jason.
Yeah, Brendan. I'm not excited.
No. Okay, I snuck in a little early, and I think I got the door locked in time, but I feel like he's going to show up. We did another Michael Caine movie.
Well, he's not a ghost, so he shouldn't be able to just appear in the room and approach us and... Oh, no.
Oi! You fucks. You dirty, dirty Canadian... That's what I'm saying. I'm going to bring nationality into it. You dirty Canadian fucks. You watch another one of me fucking movies, and I get dragged on a plane, see, because I was far away in Brazil. That's where my wife is from, Shakira. I only learned her name recently. She's a lovely lady. I got dragged on a plane, see, here in a quarantine, in a pandemical situation, eh?
Jason, it's a good thing he didn't hear you call him a ghost earlier.
He'd be really mad. That's right. Don't call me a ghost. I'm alive. I'm in my 80s, but I'm not dead yet. Look, I didn't want to come here any more than you do. I've been here, like 5 fucking times? 5. I come to your room. I stand in this fucking room, this bedroom that you sleep in. I come here and I talk about a movie I was in 50 fucking years ago. And what you do about it, what you do for me, nothing. Hey, nothing.
Sorry.
That's sorry, right, sorry. You're sorry. You're sorry because you're a prick. And a prick who can't stand up for his own life, can't stand up for his own ethics, his own stances, his own ills that he's going to die on. No, you're just a fucking coward.
Hey, Michael, it sounds like outside they're talking about raising taxes.
Oh, I don't like that. I don't. Now, look, fellas, I got to go now. I got to go. If you watch another single fucking movie of mine, understand? And I think there's at least one more on there. I'm going to come back here, and I'm going to do terrible things to your face. I'm not going to kill you necessarily, although I might. So think about that. The next time you disturb me and my beautiful wife, Shakira. Remember that name, eh? It's not the other one. That confused me too.
So her hips do lie?
On occasion, they have been known to lie. But that's none of your fucking business, eh? Is it?
I don't know.
So what I'm going to say is that Ipcrest File, great movie. Glad you watched it. Happy you appreciated it. But leave me out of it.
All right. Okay? Yeah, we're good, we're good. Oh, no, the taxes are skyrocketing.
Oh. Listen, fellas, I got to go deal with this. But fuck off, eh?
Did he disappear in a ball of flame?
Everyone... Jason, you can't leave this room without a jetpack.
I don't... Oh, that it was a jetpack. Yes, I see. The flames shot. Yes, yeah. That's why I thought it was a fireball. I just kept my mouth shut because I knew he was going to come for me.
Jason, I'm really offended that you don't get my Morning Zoo crew cues to you. I was trained by Nick and Morty in the morning. And
Nick and Morty in the morning? Who are these ripoff artists? Those guys are getting sued.
My mind tried to improv, but I was naming real people, and it was a last-minute change in my head. It could be like Nick and Lori or something.
I like Nick and Lori. That's like the whitest morning duo. Hey, coming up next, it's Nick and Lori. Hey, welcome. Hey. Is everybody awake? Somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
Coming up next, it's Sam and Jen. Nick and Lori in the morning. I think we got something there. Now we just got to find Nick Kroll and Lori Morgan.
The country singer?
Yep.
Okay.
We're going to get them together. They're going to be great. It's going to be uplifting.
Nick Kroll can work with anybody, so yeah. I'm definitely...
Jason, this is a podcast.
It is a podcast about what, Brendan?
About British film.
As ordained by the powers that be in the year of our Lord, 1999, by the British Film Institute of Britain.
Yes.
The BFIB.
No, the BR, you got it. The British Film Institute. That's the abbreviation.
Well, based on other British like abbreviations, it shouldn't like Ofcom, shouldn't it be like Brit Film? Like we do. Brit Film.
It should, but it's not.
Brit Film In.
Jason, we talk about the BFI Top 100. We talk about a movie on that list every single week, or for the most part.
Chosen by the gods of film and die.
And die, yeah. It's chosen by the gods of film who then die.
Yes. We kill them. We attack and dethrone those film gods.
So that's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about a movie this week. But before we talk about that particular film...
we got to talk about another one.
Yeah, and also I'm Brendan.
And I'm Jason.
We're going to read some comments about last week's movie, The Ipcress File.
Comments from our listeners.
Yeah.
Oh, we got comments. Oh, comments into the night. They're giving us comments.
All through the night.
When you kiss me. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going into the real song there.
We'll get sued. Stop it.
Ah! Jason, we're going to read some comments about last week's film, which was, of course, the Michael Caine anti-Bond spy flick, The Ipcress File.
I don't know if I'd say it was anti-Bond. I don't think he was trying.
Bond.
Did you see the director's cut? Was there a subplot where he was literally trying to murder James Bond, which I think would be a great movie?
I just meant in terms of like the way that spy thriller progressed. I think we kind of agreed that it was very unlike a James Bond film.
Is George Lazenby still alive?
I'm not sure.
Maybe he'd be available. He's very old. And well, I get the sense that a very old Michael Caine could theoretically take him out.
Oh, sorry. Wait, did you think I meant like anti, like against? I just meant like anti-Bond, like his aunt James Bond.
Oh, yeah, that's right. His aunt James Bond got him the job.
Yeah.
I see. Exactly. All right.
James Bond identifies as an aunt now. So comments about this movie. Our first one is from our good old buddy Sharon Horwat. Sharon Horwat has a few notes. After watching it.
Love to hear from her.
Love to hear from you, Sharon. So, The Ipcress File. This movie was a lot more difficult to find than I thought it would be. Apparently, it's now, I don't know if this is just recent, but I did find the entire thing on YouTube. So, if anyone is listening, just search for it. It is there.
Get it before it's gone.
Probably.
Michael Caine is on YouTube right now looking for it. Where's
this bloody movie? I want to take it down.
You weren't supposed to post the bloody movie.
That's right.
Sharon also says, this might be me, but young Michael Caine looks very attractive in a way that confuses my brain. Probably because the very first thing I saw him in was Secondhand Lions, which is super underrated.
He was an old ass motherfucker in that movie.
And that was 2003, so that was 17 years ago.
Wow. That was just, I think Gene Hackman was still acting.
Yeah. That was the same year he did Runaway Jury.
Yeah, there you go.
A movie that everyone won't shut up about in 2021. I mean, it's just everywhere. Runaway Jury this, Runaway Jury that.
Quick question. Oh, it is an either or. Runaway Jury, Jury Duty.
Runaway Jury.
Oh, interesting.
Like, are you kidding me? Pauly Shore is the bane of my existence.
There's some fun Pauly Shore out there.
There's not.
There's fun.
There is zero.
Son-in-law is a classic, folks. Check it out.
It is not. Don't do it. Her next note is the line, "Don't slouch about like a pregnant camel." What is this line?
That's exactly the sort of thing that Michael Caine would say. Did he say it? I hope he said it.
I'm not sure. She also says the line, "He doesn't even have my sense of humor," was a perfect joke. That's when his commanding guy is like, you're not going to like this new guy. He doesn't have my sense of humor.
Yeah, that is a good joke.
She says this hallucination stuff is simultaneously messed up and trippy. I don't know how to feel about it. And then she says, overall, I get the appeal, but I prefer more modern spy movies like the Kingsman movies, which are funny, but have very human moments to ground everything.
There you go. Yeah. Thank you, Sharon.
I will say, I thought this movie did have a lot of like grounded moments, though. I think that's why I thought it was a lot not like James Bond.
Yeah, no, I mean, and to me, first and foremost, was that fight scene that we saw in that long shot that played out like a real fight where it was messy and, you know, it wasn't choreographed. It was just two guys basically wrestling with each other because that's what would happen.
Not naked wrestling.
No.
Unfortunately. Yeah. Two movies where you've had that so far, Jason. Will we make it three?
Wait, what was the other naked wrestling?
Oh, I mean, I think there might be another one in the near future.
Keep your eyes peeled, folks. You never know what you might see.
Never know. It's almost like we record these out of order. Okay. Go ahead, Jason. Who else we got here?
Our next comment comes from one Tracy Walker.
Texas Ranger.
That's right. Tracy Walker, Texas Ranger. Descendant of Chuck Norris's Walker, Texas Ranger. What was that guy's name? Do you know? Was it like John?
I believe his last name was Texas Ranger, and his first name is Walker, and his middle name was Kama.
Makes sense.
Mustafa, I mean, Godfather.
It's like when somebody's named Jeeves. They don't really have a choice in their career in life. You know, Jeeves got to be a butler. Walker, Texas Ranger, has to join the Texas Rangers and walk a lot. So Tracy says, I had a dream the other night that my parents were Michael Caine and Maggie Smith. That's all I have to contribute. LOL. Well, Tracy, you know what? I'm just happy you're paying attention. You know, you guys don't have to send us comments that mean anything. If you have something that you dreamt about, or you have something that just kind of made you laugh as you were staring out the window during your completely meaningless existence, let us know about it, because we love hearing it. So thank you, Tracy. You lighten my day.
And then I did find out later that there is a movie where Michael Caine and Maggie Smith play a couple. I don't remember the name of it, but it exists. So, Tracy, you should find that movie and watch it.
Too Much British, starring Michael Caine and Maggie Smith.
Fancy a jaw, do you?
Patrick C. Taylor says, I've watched this and Funeral in Berlin, and they are both okay, but lack the nihilistic punch of Caine and Get Carter. Also, if you want an anti-Bond film, watch The Tailor of Panama. Pierce Brosnan plays a pure id version of Bond in that. Is that a more recent movie?
It's like early 2000s, I think. But I'm just like thinking like the id version of James Bond must be horrific.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, you'd be more like the original James Bond in the books, like just this brutish fucking asshole.
Yeah. I'm just thinking like a James Bond that acts on his every whim. Isn't that James Bond?
I mean, kind of, yeah.
All right, here we got
charisma, maybe.
Yeah, we got our old pal Eolin Allen.
Eolin.
He won't tell me how to pronounce it right. Every time I say it, he says it's wrong, but he won't give me the correct pronunciation. So I'm just going to change it every single time.
Just call him Ellen.
Eolin Allen says, enjoyed it, but good rather than great. Like how they delivered pieces of exposition and development while having scenes in unusual locations, such as the supermarket and bandstand. Just allowed a couple of asides and interactions that kept the scenes interesting to watch, then purely advancing the story. Yeah, I like the supermarket thing because I like how dated that was.
Yeah, well, and I just want to see the idea that the supermarket as a concept was new to England at that point. Like, that's fascinating.
The supermarket, get everything in one location.
Well, what would my servants do? I have them employed for 8 hours a day. They'd be shopping in 1 hour, and then they'd be sitting around collecting dust and eating various types of fruit that they've stolen from my garden.
Exactly. What will the Fox brothers do? Because I don't remember which Fox is in that movie. I think it's Edward.
It doesn't matter. They're both great.
Yeah.
They're interchangeable, but in the best sort of way.
There you go. Okay, go ahead.
Our next comment comes from Christopher Barry. And Christopher says, a much more downbeat and low-key spy film than any Bond film. Rather than anti-Bond, more anti the notion of the swinging 60s with its grimy depiction of London. It's based on a book by Len Deighton, who also wrote cookbooks. This one is very much tongue-in-cheek. Len Deighton's action cookbook. Really? Well, check out what I have.
That is, wow. What is this?
SSGB. It's about an alternate history where Britain is invaded by the Nazis in World War II and London's occupied by the SS.
And written by Len Deighton.
Written by Len Deighton.
There you go.
I was showing him the book. He showed me his book, The Action Cookbook. I showed him my book, SSGB. We had a moment, folks. You didn't see it, but I hope you felt it.
I hope you felt it. And, you know, if you want to shoot us a couple grand, we'll provide you with the video footage.
Absolutely.
I think a couple grand is a fair price. $2,000.
And that's American.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Obviously.
Fuck Canada. What?
Oh, no. The Prime Minister's coming for me.
Oh, no. I hope he doesn't assault me with his political correctness. I'm just kidding. I'm not that person. Please don't say that person.
And after all that shit, again, thank you, Christopher, for writing in.
Yes. Thank you, Christopher. Andy Utech says, I liked it quite some time ago. I do fear, though, that revisiting it might not go well. The pacing in films of this era is tough for my 2021 attention-limited brain.
Well, I'll tell you, Andy, I've been playing video games for 30 years. My attention span is nothing, and I love this movie. So it's probably, I think it moves... for a 60s movie.
I think we talked about this before too, Jason. I think when you watch a movie like this, it's not so much a problem here, but I think a lot of these movies, you have to get into a certain headspace before, yeah. right? And yeah. I mean, if we just said, oh, this movie's slow, I think we would say that on almost, I mean, a good majority of movies that we've covered, and that doesn't yeah. automatically make it bad.
When you think of it in the context of the era and the kind of movies we've watched and the kind of movies that you, the listener, has probably have probably watched in your life, you know, movies back then were slower. They took their time more. I mean, we, as I said in Dr. No, we see him walking around a lot in a way that we wouldn't see today. There was a clip that was going around online the other day. It's kind of memed up from an episode of Columbo, where Columbo walks into a room. He like looks around. He like reaches into his coat. He pulls out like a piece of paper. He goes over to a telephone. He picks up the telephone. He dials all like 9 numbers on the rotary dial phone of the thing, and then he begins a conversation with someone. We saw the entire process.
Well, thankfully, we have modern auteurs like Neil Breen, who still believe in showing you the entire entrance and exit of a character into every scene.
You can't truly understand a character unless you see every single thing they do.
Right. I don't want to end that scene until we see them disappearing over the horizon like Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
All right, so our last comment. Oh, you'll go ahead. Our last comment.
I'll get this one from. Oh, you, yes, of course you give it to me because now I have to try to pronounce this gentleman's last name. Ryan Cirotti. Cirotti?
Sure. 30? Let us know, Ryan.
Ryan S. says TCM a few years back had the Harry Palmer trilogy on. While the Ipcrest file is the best of them, I found it okay. To me, the Andy Bond would be the Matt Helm films. I don't know. They're wacky, funny, and very popcorn entertaining. Are you familiar with those films?
It's Dean Martin.
Oh, okay.
Dean Martin, there's a poster for Dean Martin in a film called The Silencers. And so the tagline... tagline says, Matt Helm shoots the works. And he's being carried by a lot of beautiful ladies in various forms of undress.
That does sound interesting. I mean, I do like the idea of a spy movie where Dean Martin's just being, you know, the drunk Dean Martin character the whole time. That'd probably be pretty fun.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Yeah, those are comments.
Thanks for that suggestion, Ryan.
And thank you, everyone. But now we come to the most important part of this section, and that is where we compare this movie, which is number 59 on the BFI Top 100, to whatever number 59 is on the AFI Top 100. So this is the segment of the show where Jason, by default, awards it to the British film. And
at this point in my life, I've seen more British movies probably than American movies.
That's hilarious. And I try to
rack your brain.
You guys were a part of that whole process where I tried to rack my brain in deciding which one is better. So number 59 on the BFI Top 100 is the Ipcrest file. Number 59 on the AFI Top 100 is the film, the Robert Altman film Nashville.
Oh, I've not seen Nashville.
What?
I've seen Robert Altman films. I've seen MASH. I think I even watched The Prairie Home Companion. I did not see Dr. T and the Women.
Not a big fan of MASH. I'm just spoiler alert that right now.
What?
No, sorry.
What is wrong with you? I thought you were a film fan.
It's not great.
That movie says, they say the word fuck in that movie.
They do in Gosford Park too, which is a much better movie.
Did you ever watch the MASH TV show?
No.
It's much better. I do like the movie, but the TV show is much better.
Okay,
done with MASH yet.
In summation, Jason, you have to give it by default to the Ipcrest file, I'm guessing.
By default, I suppose. But I do like Robert Altman, and Nashville's about what? Country music, I imagine?
Good guess.
Is it like A Prairie Home Companion, but with country music?
Kind of. Kind of. And I thought about, as soon as I found out this was Nashville, I was like, oh, this is going to be a tough decision, because I don't know. I do like Nashville a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's got the Altman staples of, like, you know, characters talking over each other, very naturalistic dialogue.
We got choppers.
And it's interesting because it's compared to like this movie, which I feel is a more realistic James Bond spy thriller. Mm-hmm. And it's got both those things going for it. So, man, I don't know. I'm going to give it to the Ipcrest file, but it's really close. It's really, really close. By a hair.
Now, what if Robert Altman? Did Robert Altman ever direct a spy movie?
I don't know.
Hmm.
Robert Altman's Entrapment.
Yeah. Oh.
I just imagine talking about Catherine Zeta-Jones' butt for like 20 minutes.
It's like when she's doing that, she's going through the lasers and you're getting the shots of her ass and stuff, and it's just her and Sean Connery just yapping at each other the entire time and not shutting up and talking at the same time and annoying each other.
Yeah. And then we cut to backstage for some reason. There we go.
And there's Michael Douglas just working his jaw up, just stretching it out, you know, getting ready for the evening.
No. Those are the comments for the Upcrest file. And now we are going to talk about this week's film, Jason. We're going to talk about the Lavender Hill Mob.
Folks, if Brendan isn't actually on the podcast, please email me and let me know. I just want to make sure that he is not a figment of my imagination and that this isn't one insane monologue.
Have you ever heard Jason and I apart from each other?
Have you ever seen us in the same place?
Yeah. I mean, when you were a guest on, what were they thinking? Was it just you and Nathan?
It could have been, yeah. Two insane monologists coming together to talk about a bad movie.
Well, speaking of insane monologists, that's nothing like this movie. We're talking about the Lavender Hill Mob out of 1951.
Yes.
Number 17 on this list, directed by Charles Crichton, who may be the director who has the movies that are like the furthest apart from each other in terms of the years they were released.
Mm-hmm.
Because the other movie he directed on this list is A Fish Called Wanda, which isn't until 1988.
Wow. Crazy.
Yeah.
That's a long career.
Yeah, he was like... in his 80s when he, or almost in his 80s when he
now is that,
that
spelled Crichton like Crichton from Red Dwarf with a K and a Y, or is that spelled Crichton like Michael Crichton the author with a C and an H and a
that one.
Okay.
Yeah. But we're talking about the Lavender Hill Mob. This is an Ealing Studios comedy, and we have a bunch of names showing up in this.
Old friends abound in this movie, ladies and gentlemen, so get ready for some familiar faces.
We have Sir Alec Guinness. As
a long time since we've seen Alec Guinness. A long time.
As our lead, Henry...
Actually, we haven't... Sorry. We haven't seen Alec Guinness since Lady Killers, have we?
I feel like we saw him more recently than that, but
didn't
I don't
we?
I don't know. But he plays Henry Dutch Holland. He's our lead. We also have Stanley Holloway as Mr. Pendlebury.
Mm.
We remember him from...
Passport to Pimlico, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, Passport to Pimlico.
And
I
also...
I believe he was in Brief Encounter
yes,
as well.
Yes, he was the was a conductor...
We have, he was the guy that was hitting on the woman.
Yeah,
in the
but he was like a porter or a conductor or somebody. He was a uniformed train employee.
Rounding out the Lavender Hill Mob, we have Sid James as Lackery. Sid James is a guy who shows up in a bunch of Carry On movies.
Is he in Carry On Up the Khyber,
he
you
is.
Know?
So we will see him
again.
So
we'll see him again.
Yeah, we'll see him again. Alfie Bass, as you remember from Alfie, but not playing Alfie.
No.
Is in this movie as a Shorty.
And of course, I'll remind the audience that Alfie Bass also played Mr. Goldberg, I believe, on a later season of Are You Being Served in the 70s. When he was a much older man. We also remember him from his brief cameo in Thunderball, where he's walking across the bridge, and I believe he gets drenched by a boat.
Okay.
Yeah, so Alfie Bass, great guy.
We have Edie Martin, who has been in a number of movies that we've talked about in very small roles, but she plays Miss Evesham.
Yes.
You mentioned she's like the older lady in Lady Killers.
Yeah, in Lady Killers, when they have that, like, I don't want to use this term, but I can't think of a better name for it, so please help me. The hen party that she has where all the old ladies come over.
Sure.
There's a very cute old lady with glasses, and she's, I don't even remember what she says, but I think she has a real funny line. She's the one that plays Miss Evesham in this movie. And she only has a very small role in this movie, but she's great.
Yeah, I mean, bigger than the Lady Killers, but yeah. There's also two cameos in this movie.
Yes.
So the man who plays the customs officer is Desmond Llewellyn, who you may know as Q.
Desmond
from the
Llewellyn?
Bond movies. Llewellyn, whatever.
It's Welsh, get it right.
Okay. You may know as Q from the Bond movies.
Oh, cool.
And the other cameo, Jason, I'm just going to play the clip and see if you can tell me who this is.
Now, Brendan asked me, and I didn't know. He said, did you notice the cameo at the beginning? And I thought he meant Ms. Evesham. But no, it's somebody else. So now I get to see if I can guess who the cameo is. On for screen
and
country. I get to say it all.
I hoped I'd see you. You run a lot of errands. along and get yourself a little birthday present.
Oh, but how sweet, darling.
So she had one line in that scene. Do you know who that is?
Is that Audrey Hepburn?
That is Audrey Hepburn.
Wow. I thought when I first saw it, I just offhandedly to myself, never even think about it, thought, oh, she kind of looks like Audrey Hepburn. Like, she got that vibe to her. And it turns out there's a good reason. Actually, you know what I wrote down was Chiquita. I thought Chiquita was a hilariously, like, just generic, like, foreign name to pull. It's like, oh, it's the name of a banana. She'd be cute if I called her Chiquita.
And it's still cute today, and nothing's wrong with that. But no, apparently this is like her first role. And she was actually going to be in a bigger part of the movie, but she was doing so much stage stuff at the time that she was kind of unavailable. But that's crazy. Yeah. Audrey Hepburn, and she's in that scene for like 15 seconds and lights it up.
Yeah,
like,
oh yeah, she's very pretty, and
right
and
away she has that presence.
I actually remember one of my thoughts with seeing that scene was like, they couldn't have got a Cuban person. Like, he seems to be in Cuba. Like, why wouldn't they have a local? But
To be fair to the movie, they do have some. They do appear to have some locals playing the Cubans. So that's good. Is he in Cuba?
I assumed he was in Rio de Janeiro. Yes, he's in Rio. I assumed because he was wearing a white suit, he was in Cuba.
That's fair. You have played a lot of Godfather the video game.
Absolutely.
So the Lavender Hill Mob is. We've done a lot of Ealing movies. We've done a lot of Al Guinness movies, but this movie is basically, it's a heist movie.
Yes.
It's an earlier heist movie than The Italian Job. We have determined that The Italian Job may not have been the forefather as we might have thought it was.
So if you remember our allusion in the comments to The Italian Job many weeks ago, whenever that was, this is what we were talking about.
It
turns out this is even earlier. And, well, I mean, Lady Killers was earlier than The Italian Job, wasn't it?
But I still feel like there was stuff in The Italian Job that wasn't a staple in this movie that showed up in that movie later. Just saying.
Okay.
Not the first heist movie ever. That would be crazy.
Yeah, no, I wonder.
There's probably something even
The Great Train Robbery, maybe, you know, from like 1902.
I feel like it probably didn't have a lot of heist tropes. I don't think there was time.
That's true.
But this is a movie in which Alec Guinness plays a very bookish character.
Yes. With a very mild speech impediment.
Yeah,
and I don't know if that's in a function of like a speech impediment that he made a direct choice, or if it's a function of the type of accent he's doing, where he's doing a very kind of posh, where the R is softened into a W sound, like a brah-brah-wah-wah kind of impediment.
Yeah, so he's doing a very different role here. And I mean, not to skip to the end, but I mean, this did get him an Oscar nomination. So this is, I think the people realize, like, this was kind of outside of what you usually expect from him. Like, it seems to be on the surface a very standard Alec Guinness isn't a comedy, like there's physical comedy and stuff like that. But I feel like if you watch the movie, it's very outside of his comfort zone, I guess.
Well, he's playing a character here, and it's a more subtle character maybe than, say, Prince Faisal in Lawrence of Arabia, but it's also not like where Alec Guinness is kind of just being Alec Guinness, which is perfectly acceptable. You know, we love Alec Guinness and we're happy to see him in whatever, but
I mean, you could argue, like, I think in everything he has, like, kind of stretched a little bit, but I think in this one, it's just so, it just feels so different. Like, I can always see Alec Guinness in the role. But in this one, I mean, I do see him. I know it's him, but I also kind of forget.
Yeah.
Because he's doing something different. Take note, John C. Reilly. No, he's great. What am I doing?
Well, maybe he should remember that Alec Guinness was also great.
Just John C. Reilly, just write that down in your notebook.
I mean, guys, I like him. He's great. Thanks, John.
Thanks.
Okay, bye. Jetpack again. It's always
you have to.
Pack.
Jason, we're on the 73rd floor. You can't just take an elevator.
That's true. There's Who's no ladder. There's no elevator. There's no stairs.
No.
I wish we had spiral stairs like the Eiffel Tower, but we'll talk about that when we get there.
There's no building, really.
No.
I mean, technically.
Kind of a platform in the middle of the sky.
I'm amazed at the Wi-Fi we get up here.
It's really good.
But this movie is about a heist. Alec Guinness works for a bank, kind of, or he transports money. He's an armored car.
Now, my question right out of the gate was, and it was quickly answered, but my question right out of the gate, once we realized that he's planning this heist, is Alec Guinness a character that was a mild-mannered bank manager, it's hard to say, that just took an opportunity presented to him, or has he been running a long con? And it's quickly answered that he has been running a long con. He has worked for this company for 20 years, the government, I believe, or the bank or something, but For 20 years he has worked. Mm-hmm. And he has been a fusspot. He is the guy that is squeaky clean, and that's demonstrated by when they're pouring the gold. A glob of gold falls onto his shoe, and he sticks it with his umbrella and puts it back into the forge, mm-hmm. or whatever you call it. He has really committed for 20 years for the opportunity to get a bunch of gold.
But do you think he's been planning it for that long?
I think this has been his ultimate goal of working the entire time to establish his reputation until the moment is right.
Really? Because I thought this was more of I don't think it's on the fly, but I thought it was more of recently, in the last couple of months or years or whatever, he's just I realize that I'm getting so old and I don't have much to show for it.
I'm certainly willing to allow that I missed something there, but what sticks to me is because at one point he talks about the fact that he had worked there for 20 years and he'd been doing this and it was finally time for this. So I don't know. If folks have any special insight, please let us know. Maybe I just misread it, but that's how I got it, that he's been working on this long con for a long time. Either way, it's pretty crazy. It's pretty crazy, Brendan. This movie.
Well, I mean, and if folks want to tell us, they can just hit us up on Parler.
That's right. Where speech is free.
Yeah! America!
And we can advocate murdering politicians, I guess?
Oh, my God.
Is that cool?
I don't even know. It's going to be shut down another year or something. Yes, so Alec Guinness.
And then a year from now, Brendan is like, well, it turns out Parler is the most successful social media platform in the planet. I was an idiot.
And now it's Left Wing?
Yeah. The leftists took over Parler. They stole it from us. Alex Jones, what are you doing here? Fuck off. I'm telling you that they stole Parler from us, and they're making the frogs gay. I want to reiterate that because I say that every time. I know it sounds silly, but that is a legit fact.
He sounds a lot more Southern than usual.
Well, he's from Texas. All right, I got to get back to a hole somewhere and tell people about nanobots and the vaccine. So goodbye, jetpack.
Oh, he forgot to start his jetpack.
God damn it! Oh. This fucking thing—it's what you get when you buy a jetpack from Alpha Brain. The pills were one thing, but now they got a fucking jetpack. I should have known it wouldn't work.
We should not give a platform
to
that man.
No, we should not. No, we shouldn't let him come on our podcast. But we're in the middle of nowhere on this massive platform in the sky. We can't help people jetpacking in.
What are we, fucking Joe Rogan over here? Yeah, come on our podcast and just talk for 4 hours, Alex.
He didn't even stay long enough to get high, that asshole.
Yeah. Okay, so The Lavender Hill Mob.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's a great movie.
So Alec Guinness is, spoiler alert. you said he's been playing this. I'm not sure, so that's the debate right now.
Yes.
So that's what's going on. So he eventually, he's living at a hotel, because I'm guessing that's all he can afford, because he doesn't make a whole lot of money.
Now, I don't get that, Brendan. Now, maybe I'm just a young kid at age 37, and I don't understand the ways of the world, mm-hmm. but... To me, in my mind, the entire life is the idea of living at a hotel was one of convenience and not one of money. Because hotels, at least today, a hotel's a lot of money. You want to stay a week at a hotel? That's a month's worth of rent in this town.
I mean, I guess it depends on the hotel.
But, I mean, if you don't have anywhere else to go and you just need a place that has, furniture and a stove.
Maybe his work pays for the hotel.
Ooh. Well, they do seem real nice, even though they don't really think much of him and until they eventually offer him a promotion. But,
at the worst possible time.
At the worst possible time.
But yeah, so he goes off and he's living in the hotel. A new guy moves in, Mr. Pendlebury. He finds that this Mr. Pendlebury guy makes souvenirs. For various countries.
Yeah, he makes Eiffel Tower souvenirs that he makes in Britain with lead and then ships over to France that they then sell at the Eiffel Tower to British children who bring them back to Britain.
Yeah, there's even a line where he says it probably cost people a lot less money in luggage if they just came here and got it.
Yeah, they just bought it directly from me.
But he gets the idea your factory is kind of is similar to the one that, makes the gold or solidifies the gold.
And this is the thing that would be more difficult today, because today we know that lead is not really good for you at all. And we would not make souvenirs out of lead, so it's unlikely that a souvenir maker would have their own foundry on hand to melt down lead. But it works here, because gold is like lead. It's very heavy, and it melts down relatively easily with the right amount of fire.
So essentially, they go through, they get two more people. They
get some real hard-nosed criminals.
Well, we'll get into it. We'll get into it. I just want to give the basics here.
All right.
They get two more people. They plan the heist, they do the heist, everything starts going wrong, and then the movie ends, and we'll talk about that later, but that's basically it.
So basically what you're saying is that there's some characters, they get together, some stuff happens, and then the movie ends.
Right.
Okay.
So Jason, where do you want to start? What's the first thing that's just eating at your mind that you want to talk about?
Alfie Bass is very young in this movie.
That was it. That was the first one.
I mean, because I have this, because I'm such a big Ari Being Served fan, I picture this old man who plays Mr. Goldberg, and you know, this is in the like mid-80s, right? So, but this is in 1951, so this is 35 years before that, and so this, he's very young and skinny, and but he's still got a big nose.
I have a big overall question, I guess.
Sure, hit me up with it.
As we start this. This movie starts much like English Patient.
With a plane crash?
At the end of the film.
Oh, right, yes.
Because he's in Rio. We don't know what he's doing. We think, oh, he's clearly got some money. He's in Rio. He's having drinks. He's having a great time. And
whatever happened, he's gotten away from it.
Yeah, exactly. Don't blame it on Rio. He went there himself.
That's right.
And he's not going to pretend his dad is.
I wouldn't blame
boyfriend.
It on that poor parrot anyways.
I blame
Is that
it on
the
Rio.
Parrot's name, Rio?
I don't know. It's that movie with Gerard Depardieu. Where, like, his
I'm
daughter...
thinking of one where Johnny Depp plays a parrot.
No, I'm talking about...
That's Rango. Never mind.
There is a movie called Rio, pretty sure. But it's not Johnny Depp.
Okay.
Wait, Johnny Depp doesn't even play a parrot. He plays a lizard.
Is it a lizard?
Rango, yeah.
Oh, okay. There, that's my confusion.
Oh, boy. Everybody listening to this is like, shut the fuck up.
This is what you get when you tune into our podcast, My Insanity and Brendan's devoted service.
Especially when this is our first recording we've done in like 2-3 weeks. So anyway, what was I saying?
You were talking about Johnny Depp in Rango.
I was not. I was not. Oh, so the beginning of the movie, like I said, he's in Rio or whatever. We don't really know what's happening. And then he's telling the story. And the rest of the movie is like the story of how he ended up there, how the heist went and everything.
Yeah.
So what do you think about like using that for a heist movie? Because at first I was like, that's weird, because then I know, like in my head, of course, not having seen the ending, I'm like, well, that's weird, because now I know that everything went great.
Absolutely. And then it's paid off by the ending.
Right, yeah. But like it's weird at first, right?
Yes, it is weird. It is weird at first, because yeah, it's like, oh well, I know he gets away with it, I guess, you know, because he's talking. It was a year ago, and he's here, and whatever, and
yeah. But I think the movie is very good in that I was able to get back into the suspense stuff.
Yeah,
but like still at the beginning, my initial thought is like, oh, okay.
But also, you know, certainly the tone of this movie going in, I didn't expect that this was going to be like The Italian Job or fucking Day of the Jackal and be like this brutal fucking, like, people getting killed left and right. And
Alec Guinness just gets blown to the fucking wall. But yeah, they do that, and then, you know, they have the movie, and then the ending. I mean, we could talk about the ending right now, because the ending is essentially like the whole time he's been sitting there, he's actually been handcuffed to this guy. And I actually didn't even catch that when I first watched the movie.
No,
I just saw them walking away, and I said, that's the ending? Yeah. Like, he's telling this guy
a
story.
Oh, you mean, I thought you meant you didn't catch it when it was in the beginning. No.
Oh, no, I didn't catch, well, nobody catches it at the beginning, I don't think, but he never moves his arm that's handcuffed, which is a little clue. But at the end, when they walk away, I literally said out loud, that's the ending? Like, just thought they just left?
This is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
I honestly thought, so as he's telling the story to this guy, and the guy's like, ready? He goes, ready. I almost pictured Alec Guinness to stand up and be like, any of you fucking pricks move, I'm gonna execute every last motherfucking one of you.
I think Quentin Tarantino had the exact same thought when he watched this movie.
That's all I could think of. But yeah, so the whole thing is that it doesn't work. And I think the main reason that they made it like that, because I think the original idea was that they were going to get away with it.
Yeah.
Because it's like Ocean's 11 now, or like most heist movies. But the reason they did it, one of the main reasons they did it, is because they wanted a decent release in America.
The Hays Code.
Yep. And in 1951, you can't have a movie end with the criminals getting away from it, getting away with it, no matter how charming they are.
Side note. We discussed that over Christmas, if you remember Christmas. Remember when that happened? Wasn't
Christmas.
That great? Christmas.
Was it Jesus' birthday?
It was Jesus' birthday, yeah. Okay. And on the night before Jesus' birthday, I watched for the first time straight through It's a Wonderful Life. And as you pointed out to me, the bad guy in that movie doesn't really get any comeuppance whatsoever.
No.
He just kind of like, he gets his money because the whole town brings up. Now, is that a question of like, was that like a violation of the Hays Code, or was it because he was a businessman and that was cool because he was, you know, doing business and making money the American way? Was that not considered a violation?
No, I think they just slid it under the studio's nose, because I think they were like, as long as Jimmy Stewart gets his ending,
yeah,
we don't have to go back to
that. That Mr. happy Potter. Ending is distracting enough. But this isn't the It's a Wonderful Life podcast.
This isn't the It's a Wonderful Pod podcast.
It's a Wonderful Life minute.
Yeah. Oh no, that would be a long running show.
Well, the Star Wars minute is. I think they're into the new movies now, and they've done the prequels and the.
So we only do one episode a week.
They do one episode a week, I think, yeah, of 1 minute each.
Oh, my Lord.
When they did the pod race sequence, apparently, because the pod race sequence in episode one is 15 minutes long. So
it took like 4 months. They had
4 months, like almost 4 months of podcasts.
Jesus Christ. All right. So what were we saying just before that?
Oh, villain getting the comeuppance. Yeah, so he gets his comeuppance at the end, and so that is allowed to be released in America.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure that's the only reason they did it.
It has to be.
Because, like I said...
But at the same time, it's a really clever way to end the movie. As you pointed out, starting off with the guy getting away is a weird way to throw out some of the suspense, but then to pay off with that. It's a good bookend, I suppose.
Like, it would probably be weird if in Ocean's 11 it started off with George Clooney and Brad Pitt just sitting there, and George Clooney's like, can't believe we got away with it.
Can't believe we did that heist we did.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Let's talk about it. And then at the end they're just like, all right, let's get out of here. Like, that's what I thought it was at first.
And then they walk out handcuffed together, and you're like, what?
And yeah, and then when I was... one of them was undercover cop. Yeah. And then, but then when I was pulling the clips for this episode, that's when I noticed. I was like, oh, the handcuff is there, but it's so subtle.
Mm.
It's not very apparent.
No, and because audiences back then, well, I guess, had better attention spans and would pay attention to shit like that.
Yeah.
Unlike the Zoomers of today with their MP3 players and their goddamn compact computers.
Oh, boy, here we go.
Zoomer.
So Alec Guinness's character, we talked about him being bookish and stuff, but did you notice, like, there's little things that he does, like, whenever he gets a moment where he kind of realizes his power or realizes, like, something's going his way, he gets this weird little smile.
Yes, yes, he's enjoying it. And we see that most prominently, I would say. So shortly after the heist happens, they tie him up and make it look like that he had been beaten up and tied up. And he's basically declared a hero, I guess, because he got robbed. He's like in the papers, and he seems very pleased with himself that he's getting all this lovely like publicity and attention.
Yeah.
And clearly, as a bookish, this kind of bookish, quiet person who's been working this con for minimum 6 months and maximum 20 years, he's not a guy that gets a lot of attention. And I think he likes it.
I think he does. Well, and I also noticed even earlier than that is when, so he's making these trips. He's in the van with the gold.
Yes.
There's two, it's basically like a Brinks truck.
Yeah.
There's two guards driving, and he'll ring this little bell.
Yes.
Whenever he thinks that someone might be tailing them or something
like
that.
Or basically he needs them to pull over and let him out because he's locked in there.
Like, well, stop. Yeah, something. I need to tell you something. So they open it up, and, you know, he'll tell them, like, oh, someone's been tailing us. Go around the corner and just see if there's anyone there. Give me your gun. And so the guard gives him his gun. Every time he gives him his gun, which is in two scenes, he gets that smile. Yes. He gets that little, like, oh, I've got a gun now.
He can feel it. He can feel the power. Now, also, my question in that type of scene, or in that specific scene,
is he doing that to Pavlov them? Is that what you were going to say?
To Pavlov them.
Like, to basically make it so that they'll be like, oh, he's stopping the van. No big deal.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. I see what you're saying. No, my question was, you're sending from the perspective of being an actual bank guy who's trying to protect the load and that's the cover he has, why would you send the guy around the corner to check something out without his gun?
Yeah, I know. I asked that too. And I'm wondering if that's just like him being like, I want the gun.
But I think that's part of getting the gun away from him later on, or having the gun away from him so that they can take the truck.
I wonder if that's like a routine, and I don't know how rooted this is in reality, so if there's any Brinks truck drivers out there, let us know your exact routine and how
I actually do know an armored car truck driver, my friend's girlfriend. I should ask her.
I don't know how much they can tell you, but I don't know.
Right? I bet you she'll tell.
Okay, we'll get the full deets. Right. But I was going to ask is like, I wonder if that's a thing where, like, okay, I'm sending you to go around the corner and check, but if I don't have a gun and they get back here, I have no way to defend myself.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
if you get shot, like, fuck, that sucks. But, like, if I get shot, the money's
gone. Then they get
the
gold, and the gold is more important than the human lives that are protecting it.
Exactly. Honestly.
That's the lesson that this movie's trying to impart.
Gold, greater than sign, humans.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But, yeah, he's very – he has these weird moments of, like, satisfaction.
Mm.
And then we get Pendlebury, played by Stanley Holloway, who is a very different, a very blustery man.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Does he consider himself a sculptor?
Yeah,
this is like his hustle. This is his way to make money.
I know we talked about it already, but I love that that's his business, is making tourist yeah. merch in England for actual merch from different countries, but and then sending it to them, and then people buy it.
But and also, it's the thing. It's like that. I don't know if that was happening at the time or if they just had that kind of foresight, because that's exactly what happens now. Except it's China. All that stuff comes from China. They just got the country wrong.
Yeah, I mean, you go to Boston and buy a shirt that says like, you know, Wicked
Boston Pissa. Strong Wicked Pissa.
Wicked Pissa. I don't think those are together. That's weird.
It's a Wicked Strong Boston Pissa.
I do have a Wicked Pissa song. Shirt, but I'm
Dunkin' of Death.
I'm guessing that was not made in Boston.
No, probably not.
But we talk about Pendlebury. Let's actually play a brief clip of Pendlebury and I guess Holland play Alec
Dutch?
Guinness. Well, we Dutch later. I want to talk about that actually too. But there, he kind of is like floating the idea of the plan to Pendlebury in his own little way.
Oh, my dear Holland, I'm so sorry. You're still feeling bad. The heat of that place. I always forget.
No, it wasn't the heat. I'm used to that in my job.
Oh, really?
Your place is very similar to the refinery.
Really? I had no idea.
We turn gold into bars, you turn lead into Eiffel Towers. That's the only difference.
Only? If I had gold to deal with.
Yes?
An idle dream. Must be a big responsibility.
No, not really. If anyone did rob our van... Oh, it's virtually impossible to dispose of stolen bullion in this country at any rate.
Yes. Oh, yes, I imagine so.
But, of course, if it could be smuggled aboard...
What a hope.
Well, I wouldn't say it's out of the question. Saying one had the means of melting the stuff down...
In the kitchen stove? What a job.
Of course not. It would mean taking on a partner.
Risky, bringing other people in.
That would be essential in any case. No one person could rob our van unaided.
You mean he'd need accomplices?
Precisely. A gang.
A gang? Not too easy to come by.
Oh, I don't know. With gold selling on the continental black market at 2.5 times its standard price, I mean, quite a few people would be willing to chance an arm for $500,000.
Yes, but how would you get your gold across to the continent?
Well, supposing one had the right sort of partner, in the form of, shall we say, Eiffel Tower paperweights.
By Jove, Holland, it's a good job we're both honest men.
It is indeed Pendlebury.
So I love that moment at the end too, like, you know, good thing we're honest, and Alec Guinness is like, oh, it is indeed a good thing, Pendlebury. And right at the end too, they have that look where he kind of like turns around and looks back and kind of,
and he's got that creepy smile you were talking about throughout the whole thing.
No, I love that. He's like, he's just like floating the idea, like, well, suppose we robbed the bank and you need a partner, right? Like, how would you do that? Yeah. Like, it's very, like...
And I had a thought, too, just tangentially. And we haven't watched this movie yet, but I wonder if Alec Guinness's very subtle character in this movie maybe was an inspiration for the much bigger Biggest Dickus in Monty Python and the... or Monty Python's Life of Brian. With the Oz, the Biggest Dickus. I guess he doesn't have that same lisp, but...
I will say I haven't seen Life of Brian in a long time, so I don't remember a lot.
Oh, you'll love Biggest Dickus.
I mean, I usually do. But yeah, in that scene, like, it ends like that, and he's very much, like, playing... He's a manipulator, right? Like, he's doing, like, a version... I know we watched The Lady Killers, and he was very obviously a manipulator, and much bigger, like, a much bigger character, much
more
broad,
cartoonish.
Much more cartoonish, and I feel like this is, like, a subtler version of that.
100%, Brendan.
Yeah, is that what you got, too?
Yeah, like, yeah, absolutely.
Lady Killers.
Except where I get the sense that the character in The Lady Killers was, like, a long time... con man who's been doing this for years. This guy, even though this is a long-term con, this is the first time he's actually trying to do this, yeah. But he's also learned over the years of working in this job how to manipulate people when he needs to.
And as much as I remember when we did that movie, you said Lady Killers, you found it looks like a little boring, yeah. And I kind of defended it. But when I'm watching this, I'm like, this is like the better version of that.
Absolutely.
Like, yeah. This is the more interesting version. The characters are more interesting. There's set pieces that That's are it, more interesting.
Because this is a movie with four white guys as kind of the main characters, yeah. And so was Lady Killers in a lot of ways. But like with Lady Killers, even though Peter Sellers, of all people, was among those people, those guys didn't feel like they had much character between them. Like, there was a tall guy, and there was the shorter guy, and there was a funny guy. Like, they didn't... But yeah. This one, like, all those four feel very distinct.
Exactly. Yeah, 100%. That's what I was thinking the whole time watching this. I'm like, oh, I can actually tell you a little bit about each character, yeah. And not have it run into the other one. It's like that test that you have when you're like, okay, watch episode one and tell me who Qui-Gon Jinn is.
Yeah, exactly. The red letter media test. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Without saying he's a Jedi, without saying, yeah. But yeah, no, I just think that whole thing is interesting where how he's like, he's kind of a version of that character. But like, also, this also starts a thing that I love in these movies is when there's like a seemingly innocuous thing that happens and it makes them think of something else.
Yes.
Like there's a moment where there's like a mouse trap on the floor and Alec Guinness puts his hat down and gets it caught. And then he's like, a trap. Yes, a trap. Bait. We have to trap someone. And they're talking about like getting people to help them. And so I actually just want to play this montage because I think it's hilarious. But they're going in public and loudly talking to hope that someone will fall into their trap. And we'll talk about it after the clip, but like, yeah, just play this.
Mr. Pendlebury. Hello, Mr. Pendlebury.
Hello. Hi, good evening. My dear, what a bit of luck. Just the man I wanted to see.
What's the trouble?
That safe in my office. Something's gone wrong with the lock.
I'll send a man round tomorrow.
I wish you would. It worries me a little, leaving the staff wages there overnight. You know the address? Gewgaws Limited. Gewgaws Limited. You know, the back of Rath being placed there.
The fancy leaving all that money there. Why, anybody could break into the place tonight and help themselves.
Come on, number five! You've done it! Stay there, me beauty, stay there!
Also love at the end of that scene, you can only hear it, but as they're at like
a racetrack,
and the guy like yells over both of them, Alec Guinness gives Pendlebury a look like it's not working. Yeah. Like he's very like, but yeah, they're basically just going around yelling that they have this safe that can be just opened, hoping that some criminal will overhear it.
Yeah, because they don't know how to find criminals. They're two honest men, right? So why would they know?
And the greatest thing is that it works.
Yeah.
And I think my favorite part about that whole thing where they recruit these guys that are trying to break in and steal the safe is that there's like another knock on the window. And I think Pendlebury is like, oh, was that another one? No, we're full up. Yeah. And then it's just like a police officer who says, like, your window's open. And there's also like great things there is that they're waiting. They're waiting to catch someone. The guy knows that they're waiting. He's like waiting by the safe. So he just takes out a sandwich that he brought with him and just starts eating it.
Really cool use of lighting in that scene too, with the shadows and everything. It was really, really nice on the black and white film.
Oh yeah. Like no, Ealing Studios movies are known for like having lower budgets, but this movie like looked really good. And especially something later that comes up. It just is kind of innovative. But
yeah. Impressive what they managed to do.
Yeah. The whole look of the aesthetic of this movie is great. So, but this is where we get, Lackery played by Sid James, mm-hmm. and Shorty played by
Alfie Bass.
And again, very distinctively different personalities.
Yeah, yeah. Where the former dude is more like kind of pragmatic, hardened criminal. You know, Alfie Bass's character, Shorty, is much more like youthful and optimistic and energetic.
And I always like in movies when criminals meet up for the first time, they never met each other. It's like, are you the one that did the job in 47?
Yeah. Oh! And they like hug each other.
Yeah, if it's like a high school reunion or something.
It's like Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back when Jay and Silent Bob run into Tracy Morgan's character, Pumpkin Escobar, and they're like, oh, we're in the drug dealers union together.
Los Angeles Local 305. Yeah. You guys get... What is he? He's like, you guys getting over there in Hollywood?
He's like,
no, we may have to strike in September.
Yeah, we voted for health coverage or something like that.
Oh, man. Love that movie. Yeah, so we get all the four together, and I gotta say, their plan is hilarious.
Yes.
Because he wants to make sure, but it makes sense if you think about it. Like, it's pretty logical. And actually, what I want to say before we lay out what the plan is,
sure.
They actually went to the Bank of England. Ealing Studios went to the Bank of England and said, help us find a way, help us devise a plan in which £1 million sterling could be stolen from your bank.
And the bank was like, go fuck yourself and get out of our bank.
And the bank said, what? We'll appoint a special committee and do that right away. And they did. They appointed...
That's the thing, Brendan. In the old days, everybody was so enchanted by the idea of TV and films that they would do anything to help.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. They made a special committee, and they were, you know, they were tasked with coming up with an idea, and the plan that they came up with is the one in the movie.
Huh. Now, I wonder if they changed their security procedures after that so that wouldn't work.
Or, you know, they might have tweaked it a little
maybe,
bit.
Maybe. I would hope
just,
so.
They gave it enough realism, but then we're like, you know what? Maybe don't show that.
So, like when in Fight Club, when he tells him how to make napalm, and he doesn't give him the right recipe, you actually got to go online to find that.
Oh, does he not?
I think in the book, Chuck Palahniuk might, but it's not the proper recipe in the movie. Because he says equal parts styrofoam and gasoline, and I think there's a different ratio.
Don't tell the people.
I'm not telling them what it is. You can find that out yourself.
That's going to make my napalm real weird, because I've been just following Fight Club.
That's why it won't work.
Oh, that's why... just gives me a rash.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
So the heist is laid out. They're going to have Shorty and Lackery basically, quote-unquote, rob them, steal the van.
Yes.
And with Alec Guinness in the back screaming, like, oh, no, save me!
Yes.
And then eventually, once they get the gold, they're going to put it into these Eiffel Tower figurines.
Yes.
Send them off to France.
Brilliant.
They're going to get exchanged.
I guess that part is never fully explained. Like, they got to get them to France, but from France somehow they can get them to where they needed to go. I guess it's harder from England because England is an island.
Get them to some shady dealer.
Yeah,
It's like the underpants gnome. Step three, step one, collect underpants. Step two, Step three, profit.
Exactly. So they whatever step two is, they know what they're doing.
Yeah. So that's their plan, and it doesn't really go according to plan.
No, not quite. Well, sort of.
So there's a scene later on where they're actually planning it, and this is one of my biggest laughs, is that Alec Guinness is, like, reading what they're doing, and Lackery's like, Edgar. And he's like, what? Edgar? And he's like, isn't that what they say in the kinema? And he's trying to say, like, they're saying Roger. Like, people say Roger in the movies, and he just thinks it's Edgar. And he also says kinema, which is a nice little touch, too. So that's a funny little detail.
I love that he's never heard somebody say the word cinema out loud.
Yeah, exactly. He's just seen it written down. And he thinks it's Edgar.
Yeah. Is he Welsh, maybe? I don't know. Actually, I think Roger in Welsh is Prosser, so.
So they go, yeah, the heist doesn't quite go as planned.
No. And he makes them leave some of the money, which they don't like, or some of the gold. He's like, that's like 75,000 quid in gold. What are you doing? He's like, well, you can't get it all. It has to look like, you were rushing.
Yeah. His whole thing is about, we need to make this look good.
You have to give me the alibi. So I guess part of it too, is that then he's then the hero, I guess, for saving that gold, maybe rather than just being robbed.
Yeah. Well, I think anybody who gets kidnapped is a hero.
Yes, absolutely. A hero. And a scholar.
And?
Vanguard for the species.
Yep, and?
My left foot.
Oh. All right, Christy. Oh, also, by the way, there's a thing, there's a little bit of foreshadowing, because when they're all planning the heist, I don't know if this was like, I only noticed it when I went back to get the clip, but there's prison bars in the background.
Hmm.
So like when they're actually... finally meeting together for the first time, all four of them. Yeah, there's just like they're sitting in front of what looks like prison bars. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Subtle.
Yeah. I also do like, and now we talked about how Lackery is like, oh, Edgar, and he doesn't get that right. Shorty also says, like, you know, as William Shakespeare said, patience is a virtue. I'm like, that's not a Shakespeare quote.
That's okay. Well, Shakespeare is the modern version of... there's a character in the BattleTech franchise who is named Jerome Blake, and he is the founder of Comstar. And in that universe, all the members of Comstar attribute every single quote that's interesting to him. Yeah. So patience is a virtue, Jerome Blake. Patience is a virtue, William Shakespeare. William Shakespeare is the Jerome Blake of our age.
I just thought it was funny that they both had like a... Yeah. Because they're both kind of lunkheads, right?
Yeah, they're both dumb idiots.
Yeah. And they disappear from the movie halfway through. Because remember, at some point, they're like, okay, we need to go to Paris to collect...
That's true. They just kind of fuck off, and we never see them, do we?
And, yeah, well, that, well, the, well, hilariously, we have Lackery saying, like, I can't go. My old lady doesn't want me to leave. And Shorty is like, well, I'll stay with you. And they're like, just give us our money in your socks or whatever. and then, of course, we know that never happens. But, yeah, they're just out of the movie at that point.
Yeah.
But then we get to, like, the France stuff, the Paris stuff. And that's when I think it really – like, it's good up till then. But I think when they get to the Paris, I think the stuff really gets, like, really interesting.
Yes, because they've by the time they get to Paris, they have accomplished the heist. The heist is accomplished in the middle of the movie, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the heist is accomplished, and there's still about 30 minutes left. And you're like, wait a second.
Yeah, exactly. What else is going on? Yeah. So they get over to France. They want to go check on the status of their haul. And they had put them in specific boxes labeled Export R.
And Pendlebury told the French lady working there, do not sell any of the boxes
labeled Export R. And but she says, like, of course.
But then she has sold them to six Paris school children. When he is confounded, she says, no, you said not to sell them out of the box marked L. I said that is an error.
classic British humor about the French language.
Yeah, so they're in trouble because six Paris schoolgirls have bought Eiffel Tower figures.
And apparently Alec Guinness is so absolutely certain that if anybody sees those gold Eiffel Towers that they'll somehow immediately trace it back to him.
I mean, I think because this might be after the scene where they mention the name of the van. No, that's later. That's later. But I mean, maybe he was just like, we know
he's paranoid.
Super careful.
Yes, yeah. We know he's, and honestly, folks, if you are pulling off a heist of your own, you need to be super careful.
You do.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you can learn anything from this podcast, I'd like to think it's about at least heist safety tips.
That's right. It's about planning, but it's also about having the flexibility to adapt to the situation because, you know, as they say, no plan survives first encounter with the enemy. So you got to be ready to improvise.
I think that's a quote from the Dalai Lama.
I think that was Jerome Blake.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I think you mean William Shakespeare.
Shakespeare, of course. Why not?
But did you notice, like, in this scene, so they're actually, like, kind of chasing, because the girls get into an elevator, and they're like, oh, we got to take the stairs. Do you know what movie kind of aped this whole scene?
Was it Last Tango in Paris?
No. Because I don't believe this is a scene where Alec Guinness fucks Stanley Holloway with butter.
Well, I was waiting. I was waiting for it because I figured every movie with Paris in it would have that happen.
No, this is Vertigo.
Oh, okay.
Because as they're going...
I haven't actually seen Vertigo.
Oh, you son of a bitch. But they're going down this winding staircase and the camera is like tilting too. And I actually, even watching it on my TV, I kind of felt it a little bit too.
It was interesting. My wife walked in while I was watching this and scared me. No, she didn't. She's not that scary most of the time.
Where are you going with this?
No, she walked in and she saw, because at the beginning of the scene, like, his hat comes off or he throws his hat and we see it floating down. Yeah. And she was laughing at the effects of it. I'm like, hey, that's pretty good effects for 1951.
It wasn't bad for 1951.
and I thought, like, when they were at the top of the Eiffel Tower, I thought it looked really good. Like, I wasn't sure whether it was a projection or whether they actually shot, like, a shot at the top of the Eiffel Tower. Now, in retrospect, I'm pretty sure it was a projection based on the following scene. Mm. But yeah, they use the effects really well. And like, I enjoy how the it's clearly when they're running down the stairs and you see them like running along the pillar is turning and they're just running on the spot.
Yeah, I like that. And like the way the camera is turning, the scenery, and the way when they look down, it does that like almost the pull focus thing, or not pull focus. What do you call it? It's that Hitchcock shot.
Yeah, where it just does quick zoom, and it feels very unsettling.
Yeah, it's almost that. Yeah. Not quite. But then I think, I mean, I would venture a guess this heavily inspired scenes in Vertigo because this is almost the same shots. And then when they get down, they're still dizzy, so the camera is still kind of wavering.
It's almost
around.
Like a descent. It's a descent downstairs, but also a descent into madness. Because by the end of it, they're both like laughing is because they're so fucking dizzy from running down these stairs.
Yeah, it's the comedy version of Vertigo. Yeah, exactly. It's crazy. And this whole scene is wild. I can only imagine people watching this in 1951.
Yeah, that would be pretty out there for that time.
And then, you know, they have so they make it. I know I'm talking about this in order, but I just think the Paris stuff is so good. But they finally make it to this like school, like track down the girl's school, which again, it's borders on creepy.
Yes.
But you know what they actually want to do. But to everyone else, this should be really creepy.
But why? And yeah, 1951, if two men come to this lady teacher and be like, yes, we'd like to address your class. We're from the company that made these things. It's like, I guess she has no reason to doubt them.
I mean, I think in 1951, people didn't really think about that as much.
It's like, oh, no, these two old men want to come talk to these teenage girls? Absolutely. Or preteen girls? Absolutely. Come on in. Say
they're
hello.
They're very young.
So and in that scene, they offer to buy, well, exchange and then pay a premium on top of it for them back to any of the girls that want to give them back.
Yeah, they're like, we've made a new design and it wasn't ready.
No,
yet.
I think the thing was, yeah, it was made of experimental metal and it wasn't ready for prime time yet. So they wanted to get them back and give them ones just as good.
Not ready for prime time metal.
So instead of gold, which is, you know, perfectly inert, they give them lead, which is going to kill them.
Yep. Except for one particular student who doesn't want to switch and doesn't want 10 pounds.
Because he says, it's the same thing. It's even better. What's the difference? And she goes, this one's mine.
And let's play that clip.
These gentlemen are from the firm that makes the Eiffel Tower models that some of you bought in Paris. It appears that, by a mistake, you were sold a new experimental type which they're anxious to have back. They'll exchange them for others equally good. Also, and I consider this most generous, they will give 10 shillings to each girl who helps them in this way. To each girl who helps them in this way.
You. That's awesome. That's from you. Thank you.
One,
yeah, good.
Two, three, four, five. Only five. Who bought the sixth one? Who bought the sixth?
June Edwards bought one.
You have one too, have you, dear? Where is it, June? In here? Now, don't be sorry, June, dear. Wouldn't you like to have 10 shillings and another one just as nice?
Oh, come, come. Think of all the sweeties you could buy with this. There we are. Just as pretty, isn't it?
Really, June, look at them together and you'll see.
There's no difference, is there? Now, come on, tell us. What's the difference?
That one's mine.
Well, I'm sorry. I can't force the child to give it up. Does the odd one really matter?
Indeed it does, madam. Were it to fall into the hands of...
A business rival.
Yes,
but that won't happen. Well, we've kept you too long as it is. Thank you very much.
But...
By the way, that is the most accurate scene in the entire movie because that is the most kid response.
Yes, absolutely. 100% legit. Like real feeling kid would want to keep it because it was theirs. It was the one that they got when they were in Paris. Why would they want to give it up? And I love that he tries to appeal to this girl is not overweight by modern standards, but maybe by 1951 standards, she's a little chubby. And he's like, think of all the sweeties you could buy with this.
I didn't even think about that. I just thought he was saying something that kids would like. And I was like, oh, they're probably making a kid fat joke.
Yep.
But yeah, no, they try to take it from her, and she's a no-go, and they track her down.
Yes.
And start stalking this other little girl, and she wants to give it to her policeman friend.
Her boyfriend.
Yeah, he calls her his girlfriend, and I was like, that's...
Well, and she asks the police officer where he is, and she goes, oh, your boyfriend's over there in the school. And so they head to the Metropolitan Police Training School.
So wait, is that really supposed to be?
Yeah, because it's like there's like an open house going on there.
No, but is that really supposed to be her boyfriend?
No, I don't think in that way. I think that she's just super friendly with that particular cop, and the joke is that that's her boyfriend.
Scared me a little bit.
Yeah, no, I literally don't think that there's anything untoward going on. I think it's just a fun joke because she's a kid, so.
Yeah. But yeah, she gives him it, and then that's when another huge set piece, right?
Yeah.
Because they notice that the inspector is there from England.
Yeah.
And by the way, like you said, this is a big police what do you call it?
It's a police school, but it's like an open house.
An open house, so there's lots of like, so literally they'll walk around and someone will be like, take your fingerprints?
Yeah.
Like, just for fun? Yeah. So they literally police wall to wall in this place.
Yeah.
And they somehow think the best thing to do is just to steal that Eiffel Tower.
Which is, you know what, it seems like a dumb idea, but given the sheer amount of people there, it works out for them because they're basically able to run around and avoid everybody and they duck through the back, you know, back behind all the booths. And
it's very mad world.
Yeah, it's very madcap. They're like huge amount of people are like chasing them and they like duck behind a wall and put the false wall into place and everybody turns because they think that they went the other way. And yeah.
It actually kind of reminded me of like a choreography of like the director of Hal, what's his name?
Hal Roach?
No, the guy who
directed. Hal Needham.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, okay.
Kind of reminded me of the choreography of like a Hal Needham action movie. Hmm. That everything just kind of falls into place. Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of madcap shit and people are like putting up fake walls, like you said, and running around.
So they do all those gymnastics, I guess.
The Gymkata.
Gymkata. They're jumping around and using pommel horses and shit. And then they run outside and they steal a police car. And what's interesting outside is that conveniently these police cars are there for a demonstration of the radios that are right in the police car. So they have a police car with a radio and they can hear all the dispatches and everything's going on. And Alec Guinness is very smart and takes up the idea of using the radio to fuck with them and give them like false information, which is brilliant for 1951. That's exactly what you're going to do in that situation.
However,
he double fucks them because he tells them they're in a given car and then they realize eventually that, you know, he's been feeding them false information and it turns out he told them the wrong car anyways. So now they're going after a different car.
Yeah, he fucks himself over. And then especially when the cop that... Oh, and then I think the most insane part of this movie, Jason, is a car crashes against a cop car. Their antennas literally cartoonishly twirl around each other. And old MacDonald has a farm plays through every single police radio.
Absolutely.
So when the cop is like hitching a ride on Alec Guinness and like Pendlebury's ride, and he's like, old MacDonald had a farm. And he's like singing along or whatever. It eventually stops. And then he hears the police radio coming from their car. And he's like, wait a second.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it goes from there. He, yep. Al Guinness manages to get away as, or so we think.
Yes.
Because, like we said, this whole thing is actually, he's been captured.
Yes.
But you notice, like, the weird thing, too, is, like, the whole thing with him in Rio, there's all these people coming up to him and like, oh, thank you for making this place so much better. You've elevated everything.
Yes, this white man from England came into Rio de Janeiro and made everything better.
Yeah, make Rio great again.
But I guess that's it, too. It's like he was living off the proceeds of those six Eiffel Towers that he had. So I guess that's also implying that that money goes a long way in Rio.
Well, he said he had about $25,000.
Yes.
Which at that time was a lot more than $25,000.
And probably, again, went way further in Rio than it would have elsewhere.
What are you trying to say?
Just a poorer country.
Are you blaming it on Rio? Again?
I blame it on the rain, Brendan.
You blame it on Rango?
Yes, Rango. Fuck that lizard. That lizard-parrot hybrid in my mind.
Not even. No.
What one scene we should talk about, too, or...
Oh, go ahead.
Before we get to the end of it, is how... After the heist takes place, there's some miscommunication about what's going on, and things almost break bad. So when the heist initially goes off...
Yeah, Alec Guinness does a lot of crystal meth in this movie.
So much crystal meth. When the heist goes off, Mr. Pendlebury. Mr. Pendlebury is like looking... He's at like an art tent that's like on the side of the road, and he's looking at some art. And when the van is coming, he goes to assume his position, but he carries a piece of art with him and basically steals it. Not intentionally, but he's just so absent-minded, he takes it with him. And of course, the guy chases after him, and then it causes this big distraction. Was that intended?
I thought that it wasn't, and then I thought it was, and now I think it wasn't because... later on, Pendlebury is taken to the cops. Like, the guy takes him to the cops, and I think he's quick on his feet to make up this story about the painting that he stole being worth all this money.
Yeah.
And that causes the shop owner to be like, I gotta go back and sell it at the right price. He goes, forget the charges.
Worth 10 pounds. Wait, I'm only charging 5 for it. I gotta get back here. Forget it.
Yeah, forget the charges. I'm going.
But he pretty much admits to the crime in vague terms to them. He's like, yeah, I am a thief. I am a criminal. Should we hear that scene?
Yeah, let's play it.
Well, you might as well know. I was lying. I am a thief. It was madness to attempt it. We weren't cut out for crime, either of us. We? My partner and I.
Your partner? Here, if you're working with the fence, who's got them other pictures?
Carry on. Oh, I make no excuses. All my life it's been my ambition to surround myself with rare and beautiful things. Suddenly faced with this golden opportunity.
Yeah. You call that picture of mine rare and beautiful?
Since you will keep on interrupting me, you ought to know it's a charming example of an early Roche while he was still under the influence of Corot.
Oh, yeah? How much is it worth?
£10 to those who can afford it.
Oh, blimey. I've got it marked up for £5.
Hey, what about this George?
Let him go. I've got to get back before they sell that picture.
Your lucky day, it seems. All right, case dismissed. Off you go.
Fucking Judge Dredd there, case dismissed.
Just do it like that, man. It's just like that. I don't know if you knew this, but in 1951, cops were also judges.
That's right.
Judge, juries, executioner.
And your lawyer, your defense lawyer, too. Oh, it was a conflict of interest. They had to stop.
Yeah, that's why they don't do it anymore.
Yeah, obviously. Just think about if it was bad for us, how bad it was for anyone that wasn't white, too. Exactly. Like, that was a real bad law. But yeah, though that scene's really interesting. And that's the reason why I don't think it was planned, because he sees Alec Guinness arrive at the police station,
yes,
having been saved, but he looks at him, and for a second, I think he thinks that he might have gotten arrested.
I think he assumes that straight through. That's why he starts confessing to the cops about, you know, I'm a thief and I have a partner and all
And then he goes and tells his other buddies, like, oh, no, I'm pretty sure he got arrested. And then they meet up again, of course, when Pendlebury goes to the hotel, because they both live at the hotel. Mm-hmm. And what I think is really funny in that scene is he hugs Al Guinness, and he's wearing, like, a police sports club sweater.
Yeah.
Like, they put clothes on him while he was there. But the other set piece I actually just wanted to talk about, and I do want to play a clip too, is when they're at one point when they're chasing the girls are going on a boat, and they need to like clear customs and all that stuff, like Al Guinness and Pendlebury, they keep going back and forth, like they keep getting sent, like, oh, you got to do this, oh, okay, we got our tickets now, nope, but you got to go through customs, oh, we got this now, nope, but you got to do it, and it's so like crazy. I love that scene. Let's listen to it.
Never do it! Must! Which way?
Here, in here.
Dover!
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 Dover! Vite, 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 vite!
Et voilà!
Ah, merci!
Et votre femme est où, monsieur? Le défait!
Non, pardon, monsieur, d'abord les passeports, s'il vous plaît.
Non, les dégâts!
Non, passeport, d'abord, pardon.
Ah! What? Passports! What? Passports!
You, Leslie.
How?
I thought I had it. Got it. Oh, vite, 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 s'il vous plaît.
Yeah, monsieur,
dépêchez, je vous en prie.
Si.
Merci. Got it?
Oh, Pendlebury.
I'm sorry, I couldn't find it.
Pardon, monsieur, pardon. Red wine, s'il vous plaît, pardon.
Oh, custom. Oh. Hey, hey, hey.
We bought nothing, absolutely nothing.
Vous n'avez rien déclaré?
Non.
Des cigarettes?
Non, non.
Tissu?
Non, non, non.
Bijoux?
Non, non, non.
Cognac?
Non, 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 non.
Ouvrez.
Non, non.
Open, open.
Ouvrez.
It's pajamas. Oh.
Hey, 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 hey.
L'argent.
Oh, sadist torturers. Money.
So, I mean, that's just a crazy scene. It's all over the place.
But I don't understand why they're doing customs upon exit. I'm willing to allow that I don't know. Entrance to where?
To the boat.
To the boat? Why would you need customs on the boat? You would go to England or wherever they're going. I assume they're going back to England. You would get customs when you got there. What's going on? Am I crazy? Was there exit customs at one time? I didn't look it up.
Jason?
But if there's any customs experts out there, let me know. Are there exit customs?
And don't try to tell me you're a customs expert when you're really just an expert at creating a custom superstar on WWE 2K.
I mean,
that's not the same thing.
That's impressive, certainly.
Yeah.
But it's not what we're talking about.
So that, yeah, and then that whole thing is just, I just, it's very, like,
it's a fun scene.
It's almost like it's Benny Hill-esque.
Yeah, exactly. Very comedy of errors, back and forth, bouncing around.
Yeah.
Classic shit.
But before we go any further, Jason, I also just want to say the car chase stuff is very impressive for 1951 as well.
Very exciting.
But before we go any further, Jason, do you have anything else to say, or do you want to go into your
bits and bobs?
Bits and bobs. It's been a while.
Yes, I would like to say some bits and bobs.
Okay, well then, on that note, we will take a brief break, listen to some Age of Radio sponsors, and we will be right back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Don't you forget about bits.
Don't you forget about bulbs.
And bits. No, 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 no. Bits and bulbs.
Alfie Bass, again, so young, so virile. Good to see him.
Have you tested that theory?
I think that that's just self-evident. Okay. It's a truth that is self-evident.
Must accept them.
I laughed at the line where he's walking into the hotel. I think the first time we see him walk into the hotel, and one of the other residents walks up to him and is very boisterous. And he goes, "You'll be the death of me, Holland." And he goes, "I sincerely trust so."
Is this the same guy that's like, "You got any gold for me today?"
Yeah, I think that's him. Yeah, real loudmouth asshole.
Yeah.
Cool shadows in the basement. I already talked about that.
Oh, we didn't talk about this very much, but he makes one of them pose as a pavement artist. He makes Shorty pose as a pavement artist and Lackery pose as like just a guy on a bicycle. Mm. And so Lackery has never ridden a bicycle, so he has to like practice it or whatever. But like when Al Guinness shows up, he's like, "I told you it was the opposite." It's like, "Well, we couldn't make Lackery the pavement artist. He's colorblind."
Yeah.
It's just a funny little detail.
Yeah. Let's see what else I got here.
And wait, I like when he's criticizing Shorty's drawings too, because he's like, "Those seagulls are way too big. Look, it's perspective, man."
Yes. A little further in the movie, the bit that I enjoyed was, so after he's this hero for getting arrested, they're like taking him around to different people. So they take him to one office and you see the name of it, and they bring him out and they go across the hallway, and then it's like the vice chairman, and then they go and they leave that, and then they go to the chairman's office, and he goes in and gets applauded. I like that door bit.
Yeah, that was crazy. And then they do the bit later where they're all having a party, and they literally have put the title "The Lavender Hill Mob" in the room that they're partying.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I'm like,
and they're singing "Auld Lang Syne."
Guys, I thought you were being careful.
Yeah, not that careful. And at one point, he's trying to identify the criminals who actually committed this, and he can't quite pin them down, obviously. But he describes them. He says, "Oh, one had he's like, one had a snake tattoo, and the other one had a very pronounced foreign accent." So it's like, "Oh yeah, okay, we're gonna blame tattooed people and foreigners for the problem."
I mean, I thought he was just trying to provide like the most different characteristics.
Yeah, exactly, and trying to throw them off the scent, but being generic, but also different than these four white guys that pulled this off.
Right.
That stair shot again, fucking great.
You should watch Vertigo.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to. I love me the general in his various movies. That's pretty much it. We've talked about pretty much every bit and bob other than those things.
All
we already
right.
hit them.
It's a lean bits and bobs.
It's lean for sure.
Well, I want to tell you, Jason, that I mentioned that Al Guinness got nominated for Best Actor at the Oscars. He did not win. The other nominees that year were Marlon Brando for Viva Zapata, Kirk Douglas for The Bad and the Beautiful, Jose Ferrer for Moulin Rouge, I'm assuming the Ewan McGregor version.
Yeah.
and the winner that year was Gary Cooper for High Noon, which is a Western that I actually really like.
Very nice.
It did win an Oscar for Best Story and Screenplay.
Ooh.
And at the BAFTAs, it won Best British Film.
Very nice.
So Jason, tell us, what do you think?
I like this one a lot. I liked it much more than Lady Killers, which is my bar, just because that's the other Alec Guinness heist movie we saw. The characters were better. Alec Guinness's performance was a little more subtle. I remember them all. I like them very much. And it was a good time. I mean, I wouldn't say this was like the most laugh-out-loud movie I've ever watched, but I really did enjoy it. And I recommend it heartily to anybody who's a fan of the genre or Alec Guinness.
Entertaining from start to finish and a lot of fun set pieces. Yeah, it's 17 on the list.
Yeah, I mean, it moves along for a movie this time, and, mm-hmm. and yeah, it's very enjoyable. So check it out. It's a definite component to your heist movie collection.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to see some of the origins, check this out for sure. Lavender Hill Mob, 2 thumbs up.
You didn't have any more to say about it?
No, it's great.
All right, thank you.
I think it should be, 17 sounds pretty good right now, actually. Very nice. Maybe it's going to be lower than that, but you know, who knows? So we're going to, it's at this point of the show, Jason, that we are going to roll the dice. So you're going to roll the dice, and you're going to find out what movie that we are going to talk about next.
This is the first physical dice roll we've done in a while. And yes. We still have, what, like 30 movies left, maybe?
And we still have this, like, rank-ass list on the piece
I'm
of paper.
I'm impressed, yeah. We've kept it around. It hasn't completely fallen apart yet.
Nope, not yet. I have used it to swat flies on occasion. All right. So you're going to roll the dice, and whatever number you get on that dice will be the movie, will associate with the movie on the BFI Top 100 that we will talk about next week.
As a reminder, the green D10 is the 10's D10, and the red D10 is the 1's D10.
So mark that on your scorecards, turn your cameras on, and get ready.
Here we go. So we are looking at a movie in the top 10.
Not too many. Top 9.
The top 9, I guess.
Nope. We've already done number 2. We've already done Brief Encounter.
All right. We'll try that again. Here we go. Brief Encounter, great movie, though. Check it out. 70. 3.
Okay, here we go, Jason. We're going to do another Merchant Ivory film.
Ooh.
This is 1985. The movie in question is called A Room with a View.
Huh. Not like a room at the top, nope. But a room with the view.
No, this one has a view. There's a window in this room.
Oh, that's
Don't good. Know if it's at the top. I can't confirm or deny, but it does have a view. All I know is I think Helena Bonham Carter is in it.
Ooh, I do like her.
Yeah.
Fight Club, baby.
Very young, 1985. Mm. I don't like that you've responded to that way, but I'm not surprised. So that's what we'll do next week. A Room with a View, Merchant Ivory, our second Merchant Ivory movie we talked about on this show. But until then, Jason, they can find us on the social media. They can search for Screen and Country on Facebook.
They can.
You can find us on Twitter at BFI_pod. You can email us for screenandcountry@gmail.com. Find us on all the podcatchers. Our home base, though, is Age of Radio, ageofradio.org, or you can go to ageofradio.org/forscreenandcountry. Jason, where can they find you on Twitter?
At Jason D. McLeod. That's MacLeod. Come on by, say hello, pull up a chair, sit by the fire.
Plan a heist.
That's right. We'll be very thorough and paranoid.
But yeah, so that's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about A Room with a View, and we'll see how many times I call it a room at the top next week. But until then, Jason, I just have to say to you, God save the Queen.
God save the screen.
And for Screening Country, I'm Brandon.
And I'm Jason.
Bye.
Bye.
Stolen.
I heard you like movies.
I heard you like to hustle.
I heard you like podcasts.
Well, guess what?
There's a podcast for you out there called The Home Video Hustle.
Damn right.
Every Friday, we talk about whatever movie PJ picks out the bag.
What does that mean?
Every Wednesday on our YouTube page, I put a bunch of movies in a bag, and PJ picks one out at random. And then we just watch it. We talk about it for maybe like an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours. Whatever we feel like doing, wherever the conversation leads us.
But do we actually talk about the movie?
Most of the time.
Ah.
Tangents galore.
Yes.
So believe me, we may be a movie podcast, but it's not always about movies. We might talk about video games.
Mm-hmm.
Music. Yeah, that's the big one, music. Sometimes we might get a little bit of politicalness in there.
Yes.
Sometimes we may just, we know what we like to do. We like to tell stories, PJ.
Ah, yes.
I am the master storyteller
yes.
of the podcast realm. undefeated. So if you like to hear about movies, video games, whatever foolishness comes to our mind, the most random stuff you could think of, check out the Home Video Hustle. You can find us on the Stitchers,
yes,
the Google Play,
yes,
Apple Podcasts,
what else,
Podbean,
what else,
Podcast Addict,
goddamn,
all that. Ain't no reason you can't get your hustle on. We everywhere, worldwide, baby.
Hustle, mother. Hustle.
Hey, we can't cuss in the promo, PJ. We gotta be family friendly. There may be podcasts out there that don't want his hair to say all that good fun stuff.
Well, you.
don't run the listeners away, PJ.
I'm sorry.
But this is going kind of long.
Yes.
So we'll end this and say, hey, check out the Home Video Hustle every Friday on all the various podcast outlets. Peace.
Peace.